More than 1 in 3 Native American or Alaskan Native women will be raped at some point in their lives. Most do not seek justice because they know they'll be met with inaction or indifference. Over the course of 2 years, Amnesty International researched sexual violence against Native American women. The recently published report, Maze of Injustice, The Failure to Protect Indigenous Women from Sexual Violence in the U.S., unravels some of the reasons why Indigenous women in the U.S. are at such high risk of sexual violence and why survivors can't get the justice that they seek. With us today is Michael Heflin, Director of the Campaigns Program at Amnesty International. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about what the report uncovered.
Well, the report looked at this issue from many different angles, and what the report found was that there is very high rate of violence, sexual violence against Native American women. As you stated in your introduction, our report and our interviews with survivors of sexual violence, with support workers, with law enforcement officials, indicated that those rates are extremely high, 2.5 times higher than for women in the U.S. population in general. And again, as you stated in the introduction, 1 in 3 Native American women or Alaska Native women are likely to experience rape at some point in their lifetime. You know,
as I understand it, it's 1 in 8 women who are raped in the U.S. among the general population. Why the significant difference?
Well, our report looked at that question, and what we found is that there are a multitude of reasons why Native American and Alaska Native women experience sexual violence at such high rates. One of the interesting findings of our report is that, and again, this is consistent with other studies that have been done, that it's the one demographic group in the United States where the majority of perpetrators of sexual violence are not from the same demographic group. So the majority of the survivors that we interviewed told us that the perpetrator of sexual violence against them was non-Native. And we looked at, you know, why that was the case, and you know, we think very much, and we concluded that it links to historic violence against Native American people and discrimination against Native American people. And if you look at this issue historically, I mean, this is not a new problem, and this is rape and sexual violence against Native American women was used as a tool of oppression throughout the period when Native American people were displaced from their territory, from their land. And so this is a historic problem. Some of the contemporary factors that contribute to the problem is what we describe in the report as a jurisdictional maze. And what has happened is that over the years, a complex set of court decisions and also statutes that have been passed have created this situation where when Native American women experience sexual violence, one of the first problems that they experience is even figuring out who has jurisdiction to investigate the crime at the police level and then to prosecute the crime once an investigation has been carried out. And this is really a serious problem. The problem manifests itself differently in different parts of the country. One of the states that we looked at very closely was the state of Oklahoma. And the state of Oklahoma is interestingly not a state that had a large Native American population originally, but a lot of Native American people were relocated there in the 19th century. State now is a patchwork of state and tribal lands. And what happens is that even when the police respond to crime of sexual violence, there's often a big debate among the different police authorities, the tribal police and the state police, as to who has jurisdiction. It's often very difficult to figure out even if the land is tribal land or state land. And that's just at the investigation level. And then once there is some minimal investigation done, trying to get the case prosecuted similarly comes this whole issue of who has jurisdiction and who should prosecute the case.
I've seen that even with speeding tickets on reservation land.
Absolutely.
That they fight over who should get to prosecute the speeding ticket. But the sovereignty issue for Native Americans is a very big one, and so they're not necessarily willing to let the state come in on that issue. I guess that's a big issue, as you're saying here.
That is an issue, the sovereignty issue, which is not an issue that we go into a lot of depth in the report, except to say that tribal governments have been recognized by the U.S. government as sovereign nations and as a result ought to have the authority to prosecute crimes which take place on tribal land. And currently, there are 3 factors that essentially decide who has jurisdiction, and those include who the perpetrator is, you know, whether the perpetrator is a Native American or non-Native person, who the victim is, and where the crime takes place. again, it gets very complex to try to figure this out in individual cases often. And then related to the question of who's the perpetrator and who the victim is, under current law, tribal governments don't have the authority to prosecute non-native perpetrators. So even though a majority of the perpetrators, you know, it's indicated from our report and other studies, are non-native, tribal courts can't actually.
Well, that's really interesting to me, because to the extent I spend time on Indian reservations, which I do on occasion, is the amount of dislike and racism involved in people outside the reservation toward Indian peoples or Native American peoples is extraordinary. So to imagine, just I'm sitting here imagining a Native American woman going into a non-Native American court and probably being treated in terms of testimony like a black person was treated during Jim Crow or even in slavery, with probably not believing her at all. So I don't know if that's an issue, but it would seem to me that the amount of racism toward Native Americans in those states is extraordinary. So I just imagine in the courts that's...
Sure, and that's consistent with some of the testimonies that we receive from women who are survivors, that they were often... Prosecutors would try to suggest, or defense attorneys would try to suggest that there was alcohol involved. So there was all these kinds of historic prejudices and notions about Native American women that that played into the way that these cases were handled.
Can you tell us about some of the stories that you investigated?
Absolutely. One of the cases that, or one of the testimonies that I remember, you know, very clearly from the Standing Rock Reservation is we were talking to this woman who's a survivor of sexual violence herself and now an advocate, and, you know, asked her what the incident rate was in your community, and she said that she didn't know any women in her community, in her, the village that she lived in, that had not experienced sexual violence sometime in their life. And you know, when we talked to other women, you know, this very much seemed to be the way that these women, similar to the experience of other women as well.
I just wanted to remind our listeners, if they've just tuned in, we're speaking with Michael Heflin from Amnesty International, who's just done a wonderful service, I think, in getting the facts out about sexual violence against Native American women. Michael, tell us, where did you go to do these interviews? How were these stories accumulated? And what kind of conclusions did you draw from your work?
Absolutely. The report is national in scope, but we look at, we did detailed research in 2005 and 2006 in three locations. One location was Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, which is a reservation that covers 2.3 million acres in South and North Dakota, so a very large reservation. The second location was the state of Oklahoma, which I talked a little bit about earlier. And the third location was the state of Alaska. And we chose the three locations because they each represent very different situations. I mean, Alaska is a complicated situation because you have many Alaska Native villages which are not even accessible by roads. There's a very serious problem of under-resourcing of law enforcement, really any ability to respond when women are victims of sexual violence. In Oklahoma, you have the situation where you don't have a large reservation similar to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Instead, what you have is a patchwork of state and tribal land, which, you know, further complicates the jurisdictional issues that I was talking about earlier. And then Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is this vast area, again, where one of the key problems was just under-resourcing of the law enforcement capacity to actually deal with the problem. Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, as I mentioned, is 2.3 million acres. There are six police officers in the Standing Rock Police Department who are responsible for policing this entire 2.3 million acres, and so it, as a result, it often takes hours or even days for a police officer to respond to an incident of sexual violence against a woman on the reservation.
What kind of conclusions did you draw from the study?
We drew a number of conclusions. I mean, one was steps need to be taken to deal with the jurisdictional problems, and some of them are very complicated as they result from the Indian Civil Rights Act going back to 1968, also from a Supreme Court decision called the Oliphant decision, which restricted the right of tribal nations to prosecute perpetrators who are non-native. We do believe that these jurisdictional issues need to be dealt with. Dealing with them is going to be complicated, probably a long-term kind of effort. But there are short-term things that can be done. On the positive side, one of the things that we found was that in some cases, state police and local police and tribal police had worked out agreements so that they could pursue individual perpetrators when they crossed the borders between tribes and state territory. And we found that when these were entered into in a relationship of mutual respect, that these were often very effective in at least being able to pursue perpetrators and to investigate the crimes. One of the other really important findings that we found, which sort of moves away from law enforcement, is really, again, the under-resourcing of health services for Native American women in particular, but Native American people in general. And what that means with respect to this issue is that most Indian health service facilities in this country don't have adequately trained personnel who can deal with cases of sexual assault. So, for example, many IHS facilities don't have any trained sexual assault nurse examiners on staff, or maybe they only have one who obviously isn't working 24 hours. And so when someone comes in to report that kind of crime, there often isn't anyone available to do a rape test and to gather the evidence that would be needed ultimately to prosecute the crime or to provide the very, very basic kind of support the woman needs, you know, as a result of having been the victim of sexual violence.
So then what happens? That evidence isn't collected, that woman receives no support?
Often the evidence is just not collected. In some cases, there is an effort made by the woman herself or her family to try to get her someplace where they can actually conduct a sexual assault examination. Sometimes that means that she has to travel, 100 or 75 miles from where the incident actually took place. Sometimes, of course, then that's a deterrent to anything happening because there's a cost. You know, one of the other realities, of course, is that the very high poverty rate among Native American people. And so once you create these kinds of, structural barriers to people being able to even get a rape test taken, it means that many women will not pursue the test and as a result will not have the evidence that they need to prosecute the case.
We're speaking with Michael Heflin, Campaigns Director of Amnesty International, and he's with us to discuss the latest report, Maze of Injustice, that talks about Native American women and abuse. We're also joined on the phone by Jesqua Burnett. She's a counselor for the Oto Missouria tribe in Oklahoma. She has a long history of working on domestic abuse and sexual assault of Native women, including in Canada and the U.S. Jesqua, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about the problem of sexual assault of Native American women.
The problems with jurisdiction, with lack of police education and support, with the cross-jurisdictional boundaries mostly, and then, of course, the actual treatment of women. There are very, very few sane nurses, sexual assault nurse examiners in our area, and the ones that are in a community at least 20-some miles away. We've got many women who don't report. Since this report has come out and there's been a lot more discussion, I've had many, many women approach me and say that they have been sexually assaulted more than one time and have never reported those crimes.
And why do they say they never report?
Distrust of the police, perhaps. If they've called before on something else and the police haven't responded, or if they're perhaps someone who is known to the police, or they know of someone that they don't feel that the police did anything for. Now, that's not saying that the police do absolutely nothing ever. It's people's perceptions of what is done and what can be done. And women in this area certainly do not feel like they're supported in the court system, and certainly the court system the way it sits now, because if something happens on tribal land by a non-Indian, the likelihood of anything being done is about nil.
Why is that?
Well, for instance, if you have a non-Native on Indian land sexually assaulting a Native woman, the BIA has jurisdiction over that.
The BIA is the Bureau of Indian Affairs?
Yes, thank you. The tribal police, the court systems don't really go up into that kind of a crime. They're not allowed to prosecute that kind of a crime, and they have to call in the Bureau of Indian Affairs police.
How long does that take?
Oh, gee, the last one that I had, it was probably 2 days.
And what does that mean in a sexual assault case?
Well, it means that the evidence can be taken by a sexual assault nurse examiner, and then where does it go? If a police officer doesn't come and collect it or collect it properly or it's turned over in the proper way, then your continuity of evidence is completely destroyed and there is no evidence, and it becomes her word against theirs. If the police officer doesn't approach her for a statement for 2 days, she, by that time, is pretty much unwilling to provide any information.
One of the stories that the report highlights is that of Jamie Rozelle. It says that she's a Cherokee woman living in Oklahoma, and she decided to seek prosecution 5 months after she was raped on state land in 2003. After attending a preliminary hearing, it was revealed that her sexual assault forensic examination, including the sexual assault nurse examiner's report, photographs, and the clothing she had been wearing, had all been destroyed. She was told by the police department that the evidence had been destroyed as a routine part of the cleaning of their storage of evidence room because she had initially declined to press charges. Because the evidence was destroyed, the DA advised her to drop the complaint. How common is are incidents like this? I don't think we would ever really accept this in a mainstream white community.
It's so common, it's ridiculous. That's just a common occurrence. It's a very common occurrence. I don't honestly believe that that's a matter of, you know, it's an attitude. It's an attitude of, well, she didn't want to report it then, let's just junk this. You know, there's no encouragement for a woman to report. And I think the thing that gets me is that this becomes the woman's case against the offender. That's not how this is. It's a misconception. It is not the woman's case. It is the court's case. It's the state's case, or it's the tribal court's case, or it's the federal case. It is not the woman's case. It does not belong to her.
That's something that's not commonly understood. When there has been a murder, when there has been a rape, when there has been an assault, it is considered a crime against the state, in addition to being a crime against the person, and that's why you have the state prosecuting. So thank you for making that point.
Well, and the thing that grabs me about this is, from a healing point of view, when I hear a woman say, my rape case, when she has no control over that rape case, from a healing point of view, that's very difficult, because if that case goes nowhere, if that person is never found, if he's never charged, and if he's never convicted, then there's a feeling of failure right away, you know, a continuous feeling of failure for many years. This isn't something like TV that gets done in an hour.
Okay. We're speaking with Jasqua Burnett, who's a counselor for Native American women in Oklahoma. Jasqua, I wanted to ask you this. Were these women who were raped, were they raped by people they had previously known, or were there strangers that came onto the reservation, or both? I mean, what is exactly the situation there?
I'd say the majority of rape cases are by acquaintances, mostly acquaintance rape. Party, relationships, friends, just, you know, a misplaced trust, perhaps. Alcohol doesn't take part in all of them. I just worked with one this last weekend that alcohol didn't have anything to do with, and it was on tribal land by a non-Native.
Is there a sense that it's somehow less serious when the perpetrator knows the victim?
Yes, there's certainly that. There's always the question, I've heard this time and time again, well, what did you do to create that situation? Why did you put yourself there?
Yeah, well, they make the victim into the criminal.
Right.
But
yeah.
It seems to me also that the non-Native perpetrators of rape seem to have some kind of sense of entitlement that they can just do this.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly the case. And it's becoming more and more common, because more and more non-Native men who have this attitude are coming onto the res and targeting Indian women.
Especially if they know there's no consequences or no serious consequences.
Yep.
And it just, as I said earlier, it just reminds you of, you know, the way African Americans were treated for years, particularly during Jim Crow period and obviously slavery.
Right.
One of the interesting excerpts from the report was from Kevin Grover, who was at the time he said this, the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs at the U.S. Department of the Interior. And he said this at the 175th anniversary of the establishment of the Bureau of Indian Affairs back in September 2001. This is an excerpt from his speech. As the nation looked to the West for more land, this agency participated in the ethnic cleansing that befell the Western tribes. It must be acknowledged that the deliberate spread of disease and the cowardly killing of women and children made for tragedy on a scale so ghastly that it cannot be dismissed as merely the inevitable consequence of the clash of competing ways of life. After the devastation of tribal economies and the deliberate creation of tribal dependence on the services provided by this agency, the agency set out to destroy all things Indian. This agency forbade the speaking of Indian languages, prohibited the conduct of traditional religious activities, outlawed traditional government, and made Indian people ashamed of who they were. Worst of all, the Bureau of Indian Affairs committed these acts against the children entrusted to its boarding schools, brutalizing them emotionally, psychologically, physically, and spiritually. The legacy of these misdeeds haunts us. Can you tell us a little bit about elaborate more on how the history plays into the current situation?
Well, what we have, I believe, is intergenerational abuse. And his statement is entirely correct and very powerful. What he doesn't say explicitly is the sexual abuse that was perpetrated there. When you take children away, and I use this often as an example, if you set up people who have children that are 5 and 6 years old and you say to them, your children are going to be removed tomorrow and they are going to go away to school long, far away that you can't get to them, and we are going to recreate them or assimilate them, basically. It's a horror story. Exactly what he said happened. Their hair was cut, which is a very important thing to Indian people, male and female. They could not speak their language. They couldn't speak to their siblings. They were turned into little robots wearing exactly the same clothing, punished severely. And then when they were 16 or 17 years old, graduated from this boarding school, maybe they could read and write, but with no real skills except for maybe sewing and farming, and put back onto the reservation or onto the tribal lands, where they found their family, their parents, had turned to alcohol, a tremendous amount of alcoholism. Now you have these children who don't know their parents, have no real relationship with their parents, have never been parented, back onto the res, and the cycle continues. And it continues for many generations. And this hasn't just stopped in the last 100 years. This has just been within the last 25 years that the last boarding school was closed. You've got an intergenerational abuse of people who were never allowed to be parents, people who don't know how to be parents, having children, and now parenting those children. We've lost a tremendous amount of leadership from our elders because of it. Luckily, there were elders, or people that didn't actually go to the school, so we still have a lot of things to fall back on with our elders. But the tremendous amount of intergenerational abuse is just, it's horrifying.
How widespread was it that children would be taken from their parents and sent to boarding schools?
I think it was all over the United States. It was certainly all over Canada.
It was all over Canada, and of course, there's a movie that you probably have seen called Rabbit Proof Fence, which of course is about Australian children, Aboriginal children, Native Americans of Native Australians who were taken into these kind of schools as well.
And the shocking thing about that movie is we learned that it just recently has been abolished, and it's doubly shocking to learn from you, Jesqua, that the boarding schools here in the United States lasted all the way up to just 25 years ago.
I didn't realize it was a Canadian issue as well.
No,
I know you're a Canadian Cree, but I didn't realize it happened in Canada.
Oh, it was terrible in Canada, and no less worse here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what it means for both women, a woman who's been raped, and what it means for a community when someone has been raped or there's been this horrible crime perpetrated against someone and there's no legal recourse?
Well, I think it makes the women bitter, certainly mistrusting. It's hard to explain to a lot of people that that is a crime. It's not a crime of sex. It's not a sexual behavior. It is a crime of assault. And have them understand that this was a severe assault. The women feel like nobody really supports them, nobody believes them, and that everybody wants them to just forget it and continue. And it's a very difficult thing. It creates mistrust in all sorts. Your life completely changes. And when you live in a small community like this, your life has changed and you become, you know, angry. You become more introverted. You become more distrustful. And the depression is just immense.
I'm just interested in what your next steps are for both of you, what you see as the next steps that both our listeners can look at some more and get some more information, as well as what your goals are. And Michael, if you could go first on that.
Well, on a very basic level, one of the things that we're hoping to achieve with this report is to raise the visibility of the issue in the U.S. public in general, and also even internationally. I mean, we're a global human rights organization, and are distributing this report throughout the world, and we have actually produced it in 4 languages, English, Spanish, French, and Arabic. And so to raise the visibility of this issue, to get people to understand that this is a human rights issue, you know, it's not just a question of, you know, law enforcement or public health issue. I mean, it obviously connects to those issues, but this is a human rights issue. the U.S. government and the state governments that are involved and the tribal governments have a responsibility under international human rights standards to not only not directly commit human rights abuses themselves, but also to protect people from human rights abuses and to really raise the profile of that obligation and to make sure that steps are taken. It is a complex problem, as I described earlier, but we think some immediate steps can be taken to deal with the problem. One of the first things that we called for with the launch of our report a few weeks ago was for full funding for a piece of legislation called the Stop Violence Against Women Act, which was originally passed in the 1990s, reauthorized in 2005. And when it was reauthorized in 2005, it included for the first time, as a result of the strong advocacy of Native American and Alaska Native women, a tribal title. And that tribal title would actually require the U.S. government to do a number of things that would begin to address this problem. It would ask the Attorney General to conduct an evaluation of the jurisdictional issues. It would ask the Department of Health and Human Services to look at the health issues and the funding issues needed to make sure that women survivors are given the kind of health services that they need. It would require that a registry be established, a tribal registry, so that perpetrators of sexual violence against Native American women could be tracked. These are really important first steps. So we're really pushing that that legislation and the tribal title in particular be fully funded. We've also asked for the Indian Health Services to receive additional funding so that they will have a greater capacity to deal with this issue, and also that an Indian Health Service facilities standard protocols be adopted at all of those facilities on dealing with cases of sexual assault, and that include training personnel so that there are more personnel trained, there are more sexual assault nurse examiners trained who can make sure that the rape tests are conducted and make sure that women get the support that they need.
Thank you, Michael. And Josqua, any additional material you want to bring to our listeners' attention?
Well, I think he really just covered everything. Those are the things that I would certainly wish for. Is it difficult to get protocols established, and it's certainly more difficult when we don't have the information about how serious this is out here. Now we do. I mean, I think we all knew, but when you see it in black and white and in writing and you hear the stories and realize it's not just this area, it has a completely different impact. I know that this tribal council completely supports this and are trying to find funding to assist this tribe and other tribes in this area. Because there are, you know, 7-8 tribes in this local area. It's a big problem. It's a big concern, and we do need that funding, and we do need it down into more into the grassroots and not up into the research end.
Is there someone that you've worked with any time in your history as a victim advocate that you really remember?
There was a woman several years ago, actually, who was... in an argument with her. They were on tribal land. Her and her non-Native husband were on tribal land. They were having a big argument, and the police were called. And she had had a few drinks, and he had also, but he was more sober. And the police let him drive off, put her in the vehicle, said she was either going to go to jail or go home. He said he'd take her home, sort of rolled her into the vehicle, and he took her home, which was a fairly remote area. And within 3 or 4 hours, she had actually killed him when he came at her, and it was after a rape. After sexual assault, he'd sexually assaulted her prior to the police showing up, and he sexually assaulted her again when he got home, and when he came after her a third time, she shot him. And I really feel like we really dropped the ball.
It seems like we dropped the ball in a lot of places here. There are a lot of stories like this in the report, Maze of Injustice, The Failure to Protect Indigenous Women from Sexual Violence in the USA. Michael Heflin, where can we get the report, or where can readers take a look at the report?
Well, the easiest way to get a copy of the report is actually to go to the Amnesty International USA website, which is www.amnestyusa.org. There's a special section on the website that deals with this report. It's connected to a larger campaign called our Stop Violence Against Women campaign, which is a global 6-year campaign. But on the website, they can download a copy of the report. There's also information if they want to order a hard copy of the report. They can get information to order a hard copy. There's also additional resources. There's a slideshow that they can look at that shows different women advocates who are working on this issue around the country. I would say one of the most hopeful things from working on this report is that there are really phenomenal advocates like Josqua all around the country who are really doing terrific work and we can do something about this problem. It's one of the messages that we want to get across clearly. And, you know, we're hoping to raise the visibility and give them a platform to even have greater success in the work that they're doing.
And there's opportunities to take action on that page.
And there's direct opportunities to take action on that page.
Michael Heflin from Amnesty International and Jessica Burnett, counselor for the Oto Missouria Tribe in Oklahoma. Thank you for joining us, both of you, on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.